Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to the political party. There's just a couple of days left before polling day on May the 6th. And today's guest is the leader of Plaid Cymru, Adam Price. Adam is a phenomenal talker in the very best Welsh tradition, a beautiful voice, real force, musical way of talking about politics, which I realise is quite cliche. But as you'll know from the Nick Robinson interview and others, and anyway, I just think sometimes there's a way some people sound that just makes you tune in a bit more. There are certain politicians you tune into and other politicians that you don't. And I first met Adam at a People's Vote rally in London a few years ago, and he really stood out. And I thought, watching, if you live in Wales, and even if you don't, you may have watched the Welsh leaders debate the other night. I've been watching all of them. I watched all the Scottish ones, I watched the Welsh one, because I love a good leaders debate. And the Scottish one's been really good, and the Welsh one was really good. And Adam really stood out. He's a really powerful communicator. And he's great company, really good to talk to. And I think, well, I'll come on to this in a bit, because I've got an email I need to share with you. So email the show, politicalpartypodcast@gmail.com. Any feedback at all about any guest, any suggestions for any guests. And this thread that has emerged, unusual places you've seen politicians, which is slightly now become a subtopic, really, or the topic has merged. Embarrassing moments with politicians. Feel free to bring those in. Email them in. politicalpartypodcast@gmail.com. Murray Bean has been in touch. And I said, firstly, Murray is a first-time voter on the 6th of May, which is very exciting, Murray. I love voting every time. But 2001 was my first election, when Labour's second landslide. And I would have loved to have been able to vote in 97. I didn't go to Nebworth. I didn't go to Main Road. I was too young to vote in 97. I slightly missed out on the excitement of my generation. But 2001 was very exciting. Anyway, so this is Murray's first. And if you're a first-time voter on Thursday, oh, my word. Enjoy it, relish it, and then, of course, you'll have a general election coming. Anyway, Murray says, for context, I was in primary six, around 9 years old, and our class went on a visit to the Parliament at Holyrood. Now, I have to break off at this point. If you've never been to any of our parliamentary buildings in the UK, you have to go. I'm lucky enough to have been to all four, Westminster, Holyrood, the Senedd, and Stormont. They are all, in their own way, spectacular buildings. In fact, this is a conversation that comes up with Adam, is the architecture of Westminster. But I have no spoilers about where that goes. Anyway, just go because they're amazing. And if you can get tickets, usually you can easily just go into the public gallery if it's not one of the major question times. And even then, you can try and get tickets through your MP, MSP, AM. Just try and go. Anyway, so Murray has been to Holyrood, which is great, and went at nine, which is even more great. And he was shown around by our local MSP, Daniel Johnson of Scottish Labour. He said, to be fair to him, he was very good at answering questions like, how much money do you make? I love that a load of kids went to Parliament. And that was the first question. How much money are you on? Are you rich? He says, now what happened was a couple of weeks later, I just finished school football training one Saturday morning. Me and my brothers and my dad went into a big supermarket to get a snack. Brilliant. While we were leaving, I saw a poster of Daniel Johnson because he was holding a surgery in the supermarket. I said to my dad in excitement, I know him, and pointed directly at the poster. However, little did I know, Daniel Johnson was sitting on his phone right under the poster. Just after I said it, he looked up from his phone. I hid behind my dad in shame and embarrassment. I remember awkwardly walking off, still holding on to my dad for dear life. To this day, nearly 6 years later, I'm still emotionally scarred. Murray, you were telling this like it was 30 years ago. I'm still emotionally scarred from that excruciatingly embarrassing moment and still have flashbacks. I'm sure Daniel is a fine gentleman and has done a lot of good in the Parliament. Oh, my word, Murray, that is indeed a very embarrassing story. So if you have ever embarrassed yourself in front of a politician, made a fool of yourself, I mean, obviously I have too many stories in that department, which you can read in the paperback version of Politically Homeless, which is out in a few weeks. But email the show with your embarrassing political stories, politicalpartypodcast@gmail.com. Oh, yes. And of course, just while I'm on news, the dates in the West End are selling fast. The night on the 25th is completely sold out with Andrea Leadsom and Keir Starmer. There's still a few tickets left for Peter Mandelson and Saeed Avarsi. By the way, if you don't know what I'm talking about, I realise sort of always presume that everyone listens to every episode. Well, I don't presume that. It's just that I get used to saying the same thing and then I think, oh, they'll be sick of hearing it. But of course, this could be your first episode. So firstly, welcome to your first ever episode. And secondly, I'm doing some live versions of the show. This show was created as a live show. These sort of weekly and daily versions are, well, they started in the general election anyway. The point is this really began life as a live show and the live recordings are very special. And they're coming back in the West End of London on the 24th of May, the 25th of May and the 2nd of June. On the 24th of May, my guests are Saeed Avarsi and Peter Mandelson, two phenomenal guests, really funny people. I can't wait for that. Tickets for that are flying out the door. The next night, the 25th, is already sold out. That's Andrea Leadsom and Keir Starmer. And on the 2nd of June, it's Jess Phillips and Esther McVeigh. And tickets for that are going very quickly. So one of them is already sold out. The other two are going quick. You can get tickets for that, for those nights. I've put the link in the blurb or the show notes. So if you just click on wherever you listen to your podcasts, you get the link there. Or go to mattford.com/live. So on to Adam Price, who, as I was saying at the start of the show, is a phenomenal communicator. Brilliant talker and has a real positivity about him. And I think that's something that I wouldn't say he was necessarily aware of it himself, but certainly talking about politics in a positive way and the power of positive ideas is clearly something that he's into. And the way he makes the case for Welsh independence and for voting for Plaid is very much rooted in that. It's a very optimistic, hopeful view of the future. Now, whether you think Welsh independence is a positive thing or not, it's kind of beside the point. It's just about the way that he makes the case for it. He just has such an optimistic way of talking about things, which is infectious. And we talk about, of course, Thursday's looming polling day, but it's a wider discussion about Wales, the politics of Wales, the future of Wales, and where Wales should look to for its future and what its bonds and ties are with other parts of the UK. He is great company, so enjoy Adam Price. Delighted to be joined by the leader of Plaid Cymru, Adam Price. Adam, there's just a few days left now before polling day. What is the most important message for you as a party to get across to the voters of Wales before Thursday?
Well, Matt, it's really that we've got to put Wales on a new path, haven't we? I mean, we've had 22 years, really, of one party leading a government. And where we look, across Wales, when we visit the communities that I've been to the last few days, you can see, you know, the depth of poverty and inequality that there is in Wales. We've got one in three of our children, living in poverty, one in four of our adults. You know, we are incredible, really, in 21st century Wales. We've been talking about child hunger. We've got 70,000 families almost on housing waiting lists. None of those problems are inevitable. And that's the kind of hopeful message at the heart, really, of our campaign, which people have been responding to. It's a message of hope and change. There's no problem in Wales that Wales cannot solve. But the first step is we've got to believe that we can solve those problems by taking our future into our own hands.
Obviously, independence is something that distinguishes you from the other major parties in Wales. But are you also running to the left of Labour, or do you not think about it in those terms?
Well, yeah, I think it's difficult not to be to the left of the Labour Party at the moment as they march to the centre ground under Keir Starmer, isn't it? So, I've seen the oscillation of the Labour Party over many, many years. I mean, I joined Plaid Cymru in the 1980s, Matt, because then we had a Labour Party then that was kind of shuffling over to the centre ground, in order to win over Middle England, I suppose. I don't know whether Peter Mandelson might have coined the term even, you know, who knows? Perhaps he'll tell us. A lot of the Labour voters in particular are coming over to Plaid. A lot of people saying on social media, telling their Plaid story, that they never thought they'd say this. You know, it comes as a surprise, I think, to people when they change their political affiliation, particularly in Wales, where you've got strong bonds of loyalty to the Labour Party, people coming over to Plaid, really enthused by a number of our key policies, which have really cut through, which is the free school meals policy. So we want to introduce universal free school meals. We'll do it in phases, beginning with primary school. But the first step is to ensure that every child living in poverty gets free school meals. Incredibly, there's about 70,000 children in Wales at the moment living in poverty, don't get free school meals. And the Labour government has been very, very resistant to that. And I think that's caused, you know, confusion, consternation amongst their base. Similarly, you know, if you like, I mean, we actually put as the title of our manifesto, "Let's Face the Future Together." You know, it's a reference to the title of the 1945 Labour manifesto. And, you know, at the heart of it, I suppose you could say is a kind of new cradle to the grave, sort of Welsh well-being state, you might call it. So we're very much believers in universal free childcare at the beginning of people's lives. And then we're introducing, you know, free social care in creating a national health and care service. And yet the Labour Party has been saying on care, I mean, that has really resonated for a lot of people. I mean, many people in the same position as my own family. My father's got dementia. My mother in her 80s herself, you know, is caring for him. And yet the Labour Party is saying we've got to wait to see what the Conservative government in Westminster is going to do. I mean, sitting on the Dilnot Commission, haven't they, for years and years. Well, we say, look, you know, hell will freeze over before then the Conservative Party finds its social conscience. So, you know, do not subcontract your politics to them. I mean, that's the whole point of having a Senedd, having a democratic devolution, surely, is that we decide our own priorities based on our values. So, yeah, you're absolutely right, Matt. I think definitely a major shift in this election is working class voters coming over, Labour voters coming over to Plaid. And that's why we go into the final, you know, days with a sense of surging support, not just for independence. I mean, that's also part of this change. You've got 51% of Labour voters, according to one opinion poll, supporting independence, but both on the national question, but also the social question, those Labour voters are increasingly more aligned with us.
And do you think that if the Labour Party is perceived to be moving to the centre ground, that's better for you? So in the Corbyn years, did you find it harder than, say, I know we've only had a year and a half or just over a year of Keir Starmer, but as a leader of the party, do you think actually Labour deserting that left flank is good for you?
Yeah, well, as I said, I mean, it's certainly why I came into the party, and I think that's been true for successive, you know, waves of Plaid activists. And I think, yeah, during the Corbyn period, and particularly the 2017 election, which I think was the high watermark, you could say. You had the, you know, the youthquake, young people voting, you know, at least according to some analyses, in unprecedented numbers, inspired by a very, very hopeful message of transformational change. Well, that vote now is very much, you know, behind the surge in support for independence in Wales. And it's essentially the same vision, but with a different vehicle, isn't it? Independence as a means of creating that massive social and economic change, which is inspiring to people of all generations, but is particularly, I think, energizing young voters that in this election are coming over to Plaid because of that.
Plaid had never done as well as you have in that first election in 1999. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, I think I would. I'm a sort of a glass half full kind of person.
Yeah, I didn't mean to frame it in such a negative way. Yeah, yeah.
No, and it's interesting, actually. There are all kinds of parallels with 1999. I'm old enough to remember it. So I think this is the first time that votes will be counted on the day following the election. Since 1999, it happened then as well. So that it'll be interesting to see whether that parallel is repeated in the results. You're right. That was the high watermark for us in terms of our number of seats. I think the reason why we did well at that election was there was a kind of there was a spirit of self-confidence. It was the dawn of a new democratic era, and you know. everything was up in the air, wasn't it? In a positive sense. And people had a sense of writing a new future together. And if that is the spirit which people feel going into the polling stations this Thursday, then I think we're going to do very well. I mean, I think if the election is about the future, then I think we will do well. But certainly that backdrop of rising self-confidence as a nation, you know, is very, very positive for us. And that's what drove our success in 1999.
When you look at the map of Wales and see where you do well and where other parties do well, Labour do well in the north and the south in those big population centres, and Plaid does well along that west coast flank of Wales. Now, some people might look at that map and go, well, that makes sense. That's the furthest point away from England. But is there another reason why you're so successful on that west coast, but perhaps haven't been able to make inroads? I know you made inroads in the south as well, but haven't quite been able to chip into those other areas.
Yeah, the pattern of support geographically, of course, is a bit different between the Westminster elections traditionally and the Senate elections. Though, interestingly, the last few opinion polls have seen more of a convergence. We've just had our highest ever recorded opinion poll rating in the Westminster elections. But I suppose there are two areas where we have consistently done well regionally within Wales. So you're right, the western seaboard of Wales, which is rural and more Welsh-speaking. Then you have the post-industrial area, so the former coalfield of the South Wales Valleys. We've done less well in urban Wales, effectively the cities of South Wales coast and the northeast. But I sense that that's changing again as a result of the growth of the independence movement. And so what you've got is a lot of urban younger voters coming into this new pro independence movement, and that's changing the sort of the geography of our support. But yeah, you're right. I mean, the challenge really for us is to be a pan Wales movement, and Wales is a small country, but there's often a lot of talk about the differences, you know, between north and south, east, west. Welsh-speaking, English-speaking, rural and industrial and urban. And I think that, the challenge and the prize for us is, can we knit this community of communities together and create a kind of a unifying narrative for the nation? And I think that what's interesting about the culture, the language, the story of the new independence movement, if you like, is that much of that... much of that focus on the divergence within Wales has gone away. And I think, Sean Jobbins, one of the leaders of the independence movement, has talked about all the myriad different ways to be Welsh, the diversity of Wales that we should celebrate as part of the independence movement. And I think that's part of the reason for its success. And obviously, that's clearly part of what we're trying to achieve in this election. And I was up in the northeast of Wales just in the last few days, and you can see, you feel it in Wrexham, for example, those Labour voters coming over to Plaid. So I think that we might get a very, very different geography of political support for our party, as we see it emerge on Friday.
You talk about bringing diverse communities together that live in different geographical areas. You know, this is the thing that has animated, for want of a better word, unionists in the UK. How do you bring together Scotland, Northern Ireland, England and Wales? How do you make people feel part of a whole? And obviously you're doing it at a Welsh level. People are trying to do that at a UK level. So do you feel that those differences within Wales aren't too big, but when you expand that to the rest of the island, actually they are?
Yeah, I think the problem with the UK union is Westminster. I think, it's the structures of this political system, which is, it's a hugely centralizing force politically. And then it's mirrored, of course, in the centralization of economic and financial, and you could say cultural power with it. The UK is a uniquely centralized unitary state. And, I speak with some experiences, somebody that, kind of walked those corridors. And, even the architecture, Matt, of the place, it's It's something like something Aneurin Bevan wrote of in first few pages of his book In Place of Fear, where he talks about the very architecture of the place, which he, you know, alludes to the you know, the vaulted roofs of Westminster Hall and you know, this sort of crenellated architecture, which, you know, kind of neo-Gothic style. It's very much, they took a page out of the book of the cathedral builders. Now, the cathedral builders were trying to pull off a mental trick, trying to make you feel small, you know, against the greatness of God. And the architects of Westminster trying to do exactly the same thing, but they're trying to make you feel small against the power of the state. And because it's all a confidence trick, you know, so everything seems to be timeless and ancient, you know, above the surface. But of course, actually, what's happening is the machinery is working really, really hard to maintain the status quo beneath the surface. You know, I mean, that's literally, I mean, that's a metaphor. It's literally true. I think they had to reinvent this boiler underneath Westminster when they built it in order to kind of vent the damn place. But so, you know, I think that's the problem. And of course, many of the people that end up as MPs, they perfectly at home in that kind of architecture, of course, because, you know, I don't know, the prep schools and the public schools they've been to, et cetera, and even some of the universities, it's the same architecture, you know. For you plant a working class MP from Wales or from the north of, you know, you feel like a fish out of water. And what happens? What happens to you under those circumstances? As Bevan says, you try and fit in. It's a natural human psychology. You know, you iron out your vowels, you know, so they can understand your accent or whatever. You even start to maybe want to walk in a certain way. You know, it's kind of, it's a strange atmosphere. And, you know, unless you're very, very careful, you can lose your entire political identity in that place. So, yeah, 9 years was enough for me. I did my national service. there's something to be said for term limits. I had to get out. I had to get out to maintain my political sanity. I admire those who can, you know, carry on doing important work defending against the worst excesses of the Westminster system for longer. But, you know, it's rotten to the core. I mean, it's literally rotten to the core, as we know, because there's a £12 billion bill coming our way, isn't it, to renovate the building. I'm all in favor of, you know, keeping it as a museum, but you know, that's the problem. Is it sucks the radicalism, it sucks the new ideas. New ideas are seen like a kind of foreign body in Westminster, you know, kind of the antibodies of the status quo, you know, kill them as soon as they can. That's the problem, and that will never change. It won't change for Wales. That's why independence is the answer to us. But by the way, I mean, I've got family in England, in my mother's English. And, you know, we need to have an English progressive political project as well, and a project for the North and for other communities that have been left behind. The Westminster system will never deliver political change for any part of the UK. And I think one of the best things that can happen to progressive politics in England is actually Scottish independence and Welsh independence, because it forces then, I think, right to the centre of English discussion as well. You know, what are we going to do there? So I don't see it as in any way being inward looking. I'm an outward looking in terms of my politics, and we want to be, you know, partners with people in England, but we can do that better, I think, by getting rid of Westminster, becoming an independent nation, and then working together as equal partners.
There's so many points, Dan. I never considered the architectural case for Welsh independence, but
I didn't take a breath there, Matt. I think we touched a nerve.
When you talk about Bevan, people will say, well, this guy didn't compromise. He was at Westminster and he founded the NHS, you know. He wasn't cowed in any way. His radicalism was left undimmed. He's one of the great titans of Welsh and British politics. He got a lot done.
Yeah, I think that certainly that 1945 government is something that you know, I think inspires me. And, you know, Eddie Butler, who will be known to some people as a rugby commentator, gave an incredible speech at the last Yes rally for the independence movement in Merthyr, where he actually talks about that moment. And my parents' generation, I come from a Labour voting family. And, you know, that Britain is something that, I think still resonates certainly for their generation, for my generation as well. So, you know, I was born in a council house. My father was a miner, you know, until Thatcher came along in the miners' strike, you know, having a very decent wage, working for the National Coal Board. You know, a classical Welsh working class story. All three of us, my two brothers and myself, went to university, got a full grant. Yeah. So all of that sense of the future being better than the past. Yeah. A fairly basic idea, you know, kind of a modest demand, you can say now, you know. But that was right at the heart of the vision. But you know what? I think, unfortunately, the inherent conservatism of the deep structure, if you like, of the UK and its political and economic establishment, eventually it took them several decades, didn't it? It took them until the 1980s, but eventually they killed it. You know, they not only killed it, they completely dismantled it. I mean, Thatcher actually talked about dismantling. I mean, she even wanted to dismantle the BBC. That project has taken a little bit longer, though, you know, with, I don't know, Paul Dacre on the way to Ofcom, probably they'll complete that as well. And that's it. I mean, and many of, you know, the writers of, I think actually Ralph Miliband, I remember going up to David Miliband. One of the first things I did when I got elected as an MP, I marched up to David Miliband and I said, I was, you know, when I saw it, I was a big admirer of your father. You know, I don't think we spoke much after that, you know, but you know, his analysis and all those writers, people, Raymond Williams, who ended up as a member of Plaid Cymru, you know, the essence of what they're saying was, look, there's something about the UK that actually means that, you know, the conservatism of the British state, of the UK, is written into the fabric somehow. You know, we didn't even properly have a democratic revolution in the UK, and that persistence, yeah, of those structures of power, some of them economics, some of them cultural, they mean that you know, social and economic progress, even where you do make some, actually is vulnerable to the basic dominance of conservative politics, which explains, you know, why we've had two thirds of the time we've had conservative governments, you know, in a country which is deep, in a nation state, which is deeply riven by poverty and inequality. And for us in Wales, you know, and for us in the independence movement, it's a simple matter of a democratic deficit then, because we've never voted in Wales for a conservative government. We've got conservative parties repeat, you know, return time after time. And look at the power of the right-wing press. Look at the cultural power of conservatism within the UK. And I don't think you're going to break that unless you actually, you know, break up the Westminster system as it is. And then that forces us, doesn't it, in our different nations to actually think again and redesign a different future.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Isn't just a more simple explanation that the Labour Party, for large parts of its existence, has turned its back on the people and hasn't listened to them. And so many of Britain's elections can be explained not through a deeply held love of the Conservative Party, but by simply being driven away by people like Jeremy Corbyn and people like Michael Foot, people like Ed Miliband. That when the Labour Party chooses electable leaders, they get whacking great majorities. If you look at the majorities Tony Blair got, if you look at how well Attlee did, Wilson won four elections, that actually Britain is a progressive centre-left country, loves the NHS above any other public institution. But when the Labour Party turns its back, that's what happens.
Well, I suppose this is the Roy Jenkins hypothesis, isn't it? That progressive realignment would deliver actually the opposite, which would be then right, there we are.
By pure chance, I'm reading A Life at the Centre at the moment. What are the odds of that?
talk of a man who rounded out his Welsh accent. I mean, I think there's a story, isn't there, about somebody mentioning Roy Jenkins, the young Roy Jenkins, then to Bevan and saying, well, the only thing is I think that he's a bit lazy. And Bevan quipped back saying, well, God, how can you call him lazy? Anybody with an accent like that who comes from Abersuch and has obviously put in the work. That was the heart, of course, of the 1997 project, wasn't it? And of course, the realignment that was supposedly, I don't know, it wasn't Granita, that deal, was it? It must have been a different Paddy Ashdown and Blair. It wasn't delivered because, of course, then Labour Party didn't feel it was necessary. But yeah, it might have seemed like a time, didn't it, during the heyday of New Labour, that new dominance of a sort of a progressive centre-left future had arrived, and look where we are now. I would put the contrary hypothesis that there is something about the deep structure. I mean, Raymond Williams even talked about the structure of feeling, which is something to do with, you know, it's almost below the level of ordinary or formal politics. There's something about the stories that are told. Every elite in every society or every dominant ideology tells stories about who we are. And if you think about the dominant stories of Britishness, they're not stories that really... that really align with centre-left progressive values, aren't they? I mean, and now, you know, we have a government which is in its ideas of global Britain and post-Brexit Britain are looking back to recreating in some shape or form some kind of neo-imperial fantasy. And I certainly don't recognise anything in that actually, appeals to me.
I'm not sure. I mean, I voted Remain. We met at the People's Vote Rally in London. I mean, I hear people say this. I've never voted Conservative in my life. I think Brexit's a disaster. I kind of don't see the whole... I know for some supporters of Brexit, they'll wave the Union Jack and they'll sing Rule Britannia and stuff. I don't really feel like this government is kind of trying to do that. Now, maybe I'm just not watching the same news as everyone else, but it kind of doesn't feel to me like an empire thing. Maybe my antenna's slightly off.
Well, I think there was a bit of a nod to it, wasn't there, in the discussion about actually Britain's actual empire in the recent report about race, wasn't there? And an inability, it seems, or you know, seeming unwillingness to acknowledge the dark past in terms of and in terms of the British Empire and its role in slavery and colonialism. But I think more particularly, it's about maintaining Britain's aspiration to be a world power, whereas really, shouldn't the focus be on what I talked about at the start, about the fact that we have child poverty, in this, you know, actually very, very rich country, and, you know, including including Wales. You know, this is an advanced industrial, post-industrial economy, and yet we're not able to meet the basic needs of our people. And yet, you know, certainly in terms of the, I think the vision that is often promulgated is as much to do with, I think, some kind of hangover of craving, craving a superpower status for Britain and wanting to project that rather than actually dealing with the problems of, you know, real people in their daily lives.
Isn't the reality of the UK actually that it's far more progressive than its critics, or indeed its defenders, would let on, in that it redistributes huge amounts of power, money and opportunity from London to and the southeast of England, all over the UK, that we pool and share resources, that this is a union of countries on a tiny little island that come together in a sense of solidarity. Now, we might not tell it in that way. We might not have the romantic overtones that Welsh nationalism and that Scottish nationalism has. It's a very sort of quiet, almost under the radar British way of doing it. But that money opportunity is redistributed. That helps create jobs, that helps fund the NHS, that helps fund schools, police officers, and all sorts of things. If you take Wales out of that, out of a union that you financially benefit from, how do you solve child poverty when you start off with a huge deficit, when you have to set up a central bank, when you have to set up all these things, amass currency reserves? I mean, even in the, you know, we talk about Scottish independence, for Wales, it'd be even worse. That you would have to, you know, you'd be looking at what, 10 or 15 years of austerity from day one. I don't understand how you square the progressive circle.
Okay. Well, let's unpack two of the elements there. So is the UK a great redistribution machine? This is actually, this is the view of people who would describe themselves as progressive unionists. I mean, Mark Drakeford, speaks with conviction. He is a conviction unionist. He's not a pragmatic or a transactional unionist. He actually believes in the United Kingdom, precisely because, as he sees it, it is about redistributing wealth within the UK. Well, it doesn't do a very good job of that. I mean, the facts speak for themselves. The levels of poverty and inequality within Wales, the fact that Wales is, you know, sort of second or third at the moment in terms of the wage league table in the UK, the household income league table, the productivity league table. And that has been persistently the case. Yeah. So the UK is one of the, you know, objectively, it is one of the most unequal states anywhere in Western Europe, certainly, and within the OECD. And what it effectively, you've got this centripetal force, you know, sort of sucking wealth, talent, people into London and the southeast, and that has persisted over generation by generation. So the UK does a very, very bad job of redistributing wealth. And in terms of Wales's own position as a nation, then actually, when we compare it with small independent countries of similar signs across the world, you know, one of the things, and this is one of the things I studied at Harvard, I'm an economist by training, is you see that actually some of the great success stories of the last 50 years have been small independent countries. In fact, if you measure large countries, you know, by GDP is an imperfect measure of economic well-being, but it's a good way of comparing like with countries with countries, because there's a standard data set. If you compare growth rates, you know, it's no contest. Small countries in Europe over 50 years have done better than larger countries. And there are all kinds of theories as to why that would be the case. Smaller countries are more agile. They're also more cohesive, you know, so information flows more quickly, etc.
But they're not becoming independent from the UK, are they? This is the problem, is that the UK is quite unique in the benefits of membership. And those independent countries aren't breaking away from a union that financially benefits them.
No, but we've got, I mean, economists talk about it, natural experiments sometimes where you can actually see, well, here's an example of that happening. Of course, we have this natural experiment on the island of Ireland, don't we, with one part of the island that did become independent, initially with limited form, but then 1949, I think, becoming a fully independent state. And then we've got the part of the island of Ireland that remained part of the UK, which is the most economically successful by far and away, the Republic of Ireland. The Republic is off the scale.
But that's a low tax. I mean, this is the sort of conservative policies you apparently disagree with.
Well, okay. And then we can look at the Scandinavian countries, which by and large, smaller independent countries in Europe tend to have actually more social democratic policies because they tend to be more, have higher levels of social solidarity within them. So by and large, Scandinavian countries are really interesting, the small Scandinavian countries, because they're both more economically dynamic, more entrepreneurial, and at the same time, they have better welfare states. So these two things that in British politics are, being seen as binary opposites, actually you combine them two in those two. And, we'd like to be a Denmark,
outside of the EU then.
Well, okay, we'd like to be in Norway in the context of the of that. Then we'd like to be Norway, which is in the medium term. Then being a member of EFTA gives you more frictionless trade, while you're able to at the same time have a single market within the island of Britain. But yes, I mean, when we look at those small independent countries, the success of those is very marked compared to larger states like the UK, which are, not only have they struggled in terms of delivering a relative poor economic performance to Wales and to other parts of the UK outside London and Southeast, actually the UK's economic performance as a whole has been very, very poor by international standards. So the UK is not a successful economy in that sense. And, we think we'll do a better job of it because ultimately what you get as an independent country is you get a whole array then of levers and tools which allow you to address those long-term reasons for economic underperformance. There's something in economics called convergence theory, Matt, which is basically saying, look, it's not natural for you to underperform over the long run. Over the long run, what happens is that economies eventually fix themselves. They fix the constraints which are holding them back. And there'll be different constraints in different places. It could be that you're underinvesting in probably the greatest driver of economic success, which is human capital, the skills and knowledge of your people. We've certainly been doing that in Wales over the last few years. You fix that, and of course, what happens then is the economy starts to grow to its natural level of performance. That's the reality of the Welsh economy. Is there's nothing inevitable about higher levels of poverty in Wales. It's simply because as a nation, we don't have those tools and levers that an independent country has in order to solve its problems.
I wonder what lessons you can learn from the SNP and from the Yes movement in Scotland, for good and bad. I mean, there's obviously a lot that they've done to make the case for Scottish independence. Depending on what happens on Thursday, they're arguably on the brink of it. But what mistakes do you think they've made? What things would you do? Or more to the point, what things have they done that you wouldn't do?
You're drawing me into very, dangerous territory. I mean, I wouldn't presume to preach to any other nation about what they should do. And in fact, I think one of the great important lessons of Scotland, I think, is the fact that contrary to Wales, where Wales is basically more or less exactly where we were relative to the UK in terms of income per capita. So we're pretty much exactly where we were in 1999. So the devolution dividend, we do like a nice alliteration in Wales. Economically, there are plenty. There have been some good things that we've achieved as a nation since 1999. But in terms of the economy, we are no further forward, relatively speaking. Whereas actually in Scotland, they have seen an improvement in their relative position to the rest of the UK, and that is you know, that is the base of everything. I've read my Raymond Williams, so obviously his Marxism has rubbed off on me. The economy is the base of everything, and I think that probably the fact that the Scottish economy has improved over this period has fed through into greater cultural and political self-confidence. And, you know, that has to be the focus for me. I've said, Matt, that it's not just that my entire kind of adult life, I suppose, has been, as an economist, has been thinking about the Welsh economy. But I've said, as a First Minister, I will take responsibility for that. Because everything else that you want to achieve in terms of public services and, you know, creating a decent society, that flows from the economy. So, you know, they particularly since the SNP government, I think in 2007, they injected dynamism, new energy, new ideas. You know, and no government's going to get everything right, but there was a can-do attitude and a level of creativity and competence. You know, that's a sweet spot. Maybe it's a sweet spot that Labour leadership haven't got right at different times. You know, you've got to have both. You can't just do inspiration. You've got to actually also inspire confidence, as well as have a raft of exciting transformational ideas. But if you can have that sweet spot of innovation and ideas, plus then the competence, and I think that's really what the SNP government, I think even their detractors would say, look, you know, this is a government has been impressive, both in terms of, you know, its program, but also the way that they've delivered it. You know, plenty of good ideas, by the way, that the Welsh Labour government have come up with. You know, it's very difficult to disagree with most of the strategy documents. I mean, sometimes I think, you know, we used to talk of there being an outside half factory in Wales. Sometimes I think, no, there's a government strategy factory just churning them out, you know, kind of week by week. Great strategy, great ideas, but you've got to deliver them. And competency, you know, and, you know, one of the things that we'll do is, we're going to create, you know, we need a national school of government to create a kind of a new wave, a new generation of public service leaders, because, you know, and that was part of, I think, the success of the 1945 Labour government, wasn't it? It wasn't just that there was these few people at the apex, you know, godlike, you know, with a vision. There was an incredible sense and culture shared all the way down, all the different tiers of government. A very, very unifying vision, but also, you know, new talent brought into government, and also a sense of entrepreneurialism. Maybe the experience of the Second World War had created, you know, a new generation of leaders at every level. So that's one of the things that we've got to do. And yeah, when I looked at to Scotland, it's that combination of competence and creativity, which is impressive.
Isn't that just a story the SNP is telling itself? Because actually, apart from independence, they haven't innovated in the NHS at all. They haven't innovated in education, and Scotland has slid down the league tables. This once revered Scottish education system is now, the SNP have taken it out of international comparative leagues because they were, well, you can draw your own conclusions about why they've done that. They actually got one big idea, which is independence, and by their own admission, they've taken their eye off the ball when it comes to things like drug deaths and all sorts of other things. The reality, actually, is that they're seen as perhaps the most competent party, but they haven't innovated at all when it comes to the public sector. And as for their economy, they get more per head funding than the rest of the UK. And they've been able to borrow a lot as a member of the UK. They get more spending per head. All they've done is manage the status quo.
Well, I think that, you know, you look, for example, at their level of infrastructure investment, even though they have a borrowing cap placed upon them by the UK government. It's a higher rate than Wales. But have they just accepted that? I mean, that's what basically the Welsh government have said. Well, you know, we can only borrow 150 million a year. In fact, they haven't even spent that and claimed that in most years, which is bizarre. When there's so much infrastructure need. But, you know, what the Scottish government did, they came up with a plan B. And so they didn't just accept the borrowing constraints. They realized that after skills, after human capital, you know, according to the OECD, the next biggest determinant of economic success is infrastructure. And so what they did is they created a plan B, you know, revenue funded investment, as they call it, basically using their revenue budget to pay for infrastructure investment programs through the Scottish Futures Trust, etc. So yeah, I it's no surprise I don't quite share your analysis, and you know their level of progress in terms of renewables. I mean, you know, compared to Wales and Scotland, we're both wet and windy countries. You know, we're surrounded on three sides by sea, like them. But they've done a far better job of realizing that economic potential. You know, Wales and Scotland, you could say we've got an unfair advantage in terms of renewable energy, particularly marine energy. But they've been much better at being strategic and thinking, right, okay, here's an opportunity for us. Let's go after it.
Isn't there a problem at the heart of Welsh and Scottish independence that both of you talk about wanting to be like Scandinavian countries and severing the links of this inherently conservative union and everything, when actually Scotland, Wales and England have so much in common, more in common than they do with any Scandinavian country, more than they do with America or any European country. And what you're trying to do actually is kind of drive a wedge and create divisions between three really close neighbours, a family, really, when actually the public perhaps don't feel that way. The Welsh public don't look to Norway and to Denmark. They go, you quite like England. We like going to Bristol. Why do you want to make it harder?
Yeah, no, I think that we don't just need a new Wales. We need a new Britain.
But we can achieve that together, Adam. Why can't we do that together?
We can achieve it together as equal partners, and we can do that better as independent nations. But I agree that there are so many important bonds and ties between the nations of this island, and I think that we do need to have an architecture, you know, of cooperation. Yeah, so there'll be so many things that we want to work together on, right?
But people will say that already exists. We've got the architecture. Why dismantle it?
Yeah, because I mean, as I said, you know, don't get me back on architecture. Now, Westminster.
I like the architecture of Westminster, and I went to state school. I think it's beautiful.
It's good for the tourists, but it's not good for a functioning democracy, right? Okay. Look, and move the capital of England to the, you know, to somewhere more nearer the geographic centre.
I mean, stuff like that. You go, why? Everyone knows it's London. People like going to London. Why do we have to have these sort of tokenistic gesture stuff when people go, we know it's in London. We don't have a problem with it. We don't want to move the capital, for crying out loud. We'd rather sort out our NHS.
Well, you know, I because where the minds of those policymakers are, does have an effect. You know, they're steeped in a particular culture, and if you've got to change that somehow or other. But you know, I mean, it's up to the people of England, right? Okay, where the capital should be. Right? I did actually do Westminster Hall debate, arguing that it should be moved to Liverpool, I got a lot of support for that
in Liverpool.
Yeah, but look, yes, we've got to create ways of working together on this island. But Westminster is the block of that, right? We've got to bypass that. We've got to start with something new. And I think, yeah, we've got to create a new Britain as well. We talked about in our Independence Commission report about creating a sort of a confederalism where we work together, but as independent countries. So you've got things like the Benelux countries, of course. They've got the Benelux Union. You've got the Nordic Council, where those Nordic countries actually work together in a formal way. Yeah. So yeah, pooling sovereignty in that way, where you're an independent country, absolutely. And we want to do that, but the problem at the moment is we've got a Westminster Parliament. It's a unitary state. It believes it actually explicitly says we are supreme. The supremacy, you know, this is like, it's not just they believe it, they're frightened of saying. They actually say we are supreme, and we're going to go to the Supreme Court, and we're going to, you know, kind of defeat you. They're doing it repeatedly, aren't they, with bills from the Scottish Parliament over enshrining the children's rights into Scottish law. My goodness gracious me. Shouldn't that be up to the people of Scotland, and similarly with Wales as well? So it's never going to work where you have this attitude of Westminster supremacism, and also, you know, a the sheer fact, of course, when, you know, it's very, very difficult to have a union of well, four constituent nations, and one of them has got 85% of the population. You're always going to be outvoted. Better to create that cooperation, but do it on the basis of equal partners as independent countries coming together, and then we can work together.
And you mentioned earlier your time at Harvard. You took a bit of time out from politics to study over there. At that point, were you maybe at a crossroads? Did you think, I'm going to just do this for a bit, see how it feels, and I might not go back into politics?
I definitely needed some time out, kind of basically to refresh my thinking. I mean, it, you know, when you're in the sort of political trenches at Westminster, you're using up all your knowledge capital. You don't really add to it. I mean, there's experience in terms of the, you know, the art of politics, for want of a better term. But I felt, you know, I needed to go back and study Kennedy School and, you know, soak up ideas. I always had at the back of my mind that I'd like to go back into politics in the Senate and spend some time out. I worked after Kennedy School at Nesta, working with Jeff Mulgan, part of the Labour government as the head of the strategy unit there. I was the chief executive at the time, so working on innovation in public services, etc. I wanted to go back into politics with some ideas, with a bank of ideas, you know, sort of looking around the world at global best practice. And, you know, I was very fortunate. So, you know, at the Kennedy School at the time, Mark Moore, the guy who came up with the idea of public value. So how can you create an entrepreneurial state? People like Ricardo Hausmann, an economist who's sort of brought in ideas about how you do economic development if you're an underperforming economy. So fantastically useful. But I remember I was at an Occupy. Occupy was happening at the time when I was in Boston, and I was at a protest. And then one of my lecturers, Marshall Gans, who's a sort of famous figure from the civil rights movement in the 1960s, et cetera, and a former teacher of Obama. And he saw me in the crowd. It was quite embarrassing at the time. And, you know, in the mid-sentence, mid-speech, he said, Adam, it's time to go back to Wales.
You meant that in a nice way.
Yeah, in the nice way. It's like, you know, your job is not to be protesting inequality here. Get back to Wales now. And then carried on. So I thought, well, fair enough then.
Well, on that note, Adam, I shall let you get back to the campaign trail and not keep you anymore. It's been such a pleasure. It'd be great to get you back on after Thursday. We'll see what happens in the results.
Look forward to it. Yeah,
and have a proper detailed chat about Welsh independence and what's happening with it. And it may be more on the table in a few days' time.
Yeah. No, absolutely. There's no more powerful force in politics than momentum. And I think there's definitely a surge in support happening.
I'm sure Jeremy Corbyn would agree.
With a small M, you know, it's a universal idea.
Adam, thank you so much. There you go, Adam Price, brilliant company. Great to talk to him. I'd love to get him back on because, and I know this is a cliche, and I say it with so many guests, but really, and I really, really mean it with Adam, and I always mean it when I say it, but there was so much more to talk about. And obviously, he gives such great long answers. Which is welcome. This is the whole point of the show, is that politicians get more time to give more detail, and then listeners are get more of a sense of them and a better case put. But I do, there's so much more I wanted to get onto that we didn't get onto. But he's great company, and I think the essence, the spirit of the show was really there, in that you can talk about these things in good nature. And enjoy them as a kind of discussion point. Now, obviously, Adam is not here just to enjoy a discussion. He's here to try and get Wales as an independent state. So we will see on Thursday the 6th of May, just a couple of days' time, if he is successful in moving that debate forward. And what happens? Plaid and Labour have been in coalition a couple of times before. There's one more episode before, well, that I'll put out on polling day as a polling day treat for you all, because obviously you'll all be getting up at the crack of dawn to go out leafleting and everything, or indeed be leafleted. That's the two types of people in the world. People who hand out leaflets, people who get leafleted. There must be a third group. In fact, depending on where you live, you're definitely in the third group of people who basically never get a leaflet. Oh, to be you. Oh, to be that lucky group. I'm not sure that is true. Am I spreading anti-politics propaganda on this podcast? There must be some people who never get them. Although sometimes, you know, people would say that in defense of leafleters. They'd say, you never put a leaflet through my door. And I'd say, I think I leafleted this street. Oh, yeah, well, apart from that. And you go, well, okay. So maybe that third group doesn't exist in the UK. Let's hope it doesn't. Anyway, make sure you vote on Thursday. If you haven't sent your postal vote form back yet, you can hand it in at a polling station. So make sure you do that if you haven't done that. And if you are registered to vote, please go down to your polling station and vote wherever you live in Britain and make your voice heard. It's very exciting. And of course, the outcomes are thrilling to see what happens. Does Sadiq Khan win another term as Mayor of London? Does he do it on first preference votes alone? What happens in Scotland? What happens in Wales? What happens with our Metro Mayors? Do Labour take back? Well, not take back. Do the Conservatives hold the West Midlands, or does Liam Byrne become Mayor of the West Midlands? So all these interesting results to watch on Thursday, including what happens to Adam Price and Plaid in Wales. And after polling day, I'll do a few episodes where we look in detail at the results and what happened in various different parts of the UK. So thank you for downloading this. Thank you for all the lovely reviews you put on iTunes. Please keep doing that, because if you leave a 5-star review and say nice things, it pushes the show up the charts and it means that more people can enjoy this wonderful festival of democracy. And this podcast in particular. So I'll leave you to it. It's polling week, which I still feel a buzz about, even though I don't work in politics anymore. And I've already sent my postal vote back. I think it's the results. I love looking at the results and the changes or the lack of change or whatever. I just love all the graphs and the polls and the analysis and everything. So I will aim to make this podcast part of that and do some in-depth conversations with particular figures in different parts of the UK after Thursday. But I'm just repeating myself now. So I'm going to go. I'm going to let you get on with this week, this wonderful week. And I'll see you soon. Oh, and don't forget, tickets for those shows, apart from the 25th, which is already sold out, available at mattford.com/live. Ta-ra.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.